A lot of the races on Arizona's ballot have been contentious, but few are this far down the ballot. This election is
tense, divisive, polarizing.
I believe the future of Gilbert Public Schools is at stake.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the Gilbert Public School Board election, also what the court-appointed monitor found in the sheriff's office.
It's been a banner year for mosquitoes in Maricopa County.
And those foul-smelling creatures on your lawn tonight might not be trick-or-treaters.
The sounds for, like, to warn the others is they almost like a... I call it like a woof sound.
Woof, woof, woof. Ugh, scary. Plus, the latest on the Navajo presidential election, change the clocks or not, and our community series takes a turn in the bowl.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Afternoon commute is getting off to kind of a tough start. Some accidents to tell you about. I-17 northbound at Glendale. The center lane's blocked by an accident there. 101 northbound in the East Valley, an accident blocking the McDowell Road on-ramp. And on the 202 Santan Freeway eastbound, an accident at Alma School has the HOV lane blocked. Look for partly cloudy skies across the valley tonight. Overnight lows in the upper 60s. It's 93 degrees. Right now,
a Chandler police officer has died after being hit by a suspected drunken driver, becoming the second officer from the Chandler Police Department to be killed in motorcycle crashes this week. Police say 37-year-old officer David Payne was stopped at a red light early this morning when a vehicle hit his motorcycle from behind. A police spokesman says the other driver left the scene, but officers stopped him a short time later and took him into custody.
The University of Arizona's College of Health Science hosted a disaster preparedness program today. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the event brought students together from across the state.
The program was held at locations in Phoenix, Tucson, and Flagstaff on Friday morning. The students who attended came from a variety of backgrounds, from nursing and internal medicine to law and social work. The event simulated a flu pandemic. Janet Foote is with the University of Arizona. She says the exercise makes the students tackle the questions that often arise in that situation, like who gets a vaccine and who doesn't.
In teaching, we're so worried about educating our own discipline. We don't always think about all the teamwork that's necessary once you get into a career.
This is the eighth year the event has been held. With the recent attention to high-profile diseases such as Ebola and enterovirus, instructors say this year's drill is especially relevant. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This week, a court-appointed monitor released a highly critical report of the way the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office has handled its investigation into a dead former deputy, and with me now is Jude Joffe Block. Jude, let's go over the details of the case first. The Sheriff's Office began the investigation after a deputy, Charlie Armendariz, was found dead in his home.
Right, and just days before that, he was arrested after the Sheriff's Office discovered an unusual collection of things in his garage. There were drugs and evidence bags and a legal weapon, as well as, the weirdest part, hundreds of IDs and driver's licenses, license plates, plus tons of discs of videos of himself making traffic stops.
And so the sheriff's office began an investigation. What we have now is the court-appointed monitor saying that investigation was poorly planned and executed from the start.
Right. And this court-appointed monitor is in place because a federal judge ruled last year that the sheriff's office racially profiled Latino drivers. And that judge ordered this monitor to oversee these reforms at the sheriff's office that he's now ordering. The monitor's Robert Warshaw. He has a big team that's working with the agency now. And for us in the public, the fact that this monitor is there advising the sheriff's office and also publishing his findings means we have much more of a window into what's happening at this agency than we ever did before.
All right, so take us through what Robert Warshaw, the monitor, found.
So the monitor's report has a few new details about Armendariz's death. For example, he apparently left behind a 35-minute goodbye video. And warning, this is a little bit disturbing, but when Armendariz was found in his home, he was lying face down with his head suspended just a few inches off the ground by a rope that was hanging off a pool table. But the bigger story in this report is that MCSO, the sheriff's office, made several missteps in its investigation that stemmed from the suicide. One of the monitor's complaints is that the leadership at the sheriff's office seemed to believe that Armendariz was a rogue agent who acted alone, and they didn't appear to be very zealous about trying to find out if the misconduct was more widespread than just Armendariz.
All right, so what kind of mistakes are we talking about at the sheriff's office?
Well, a lot of this has to do with videos. So Armendariz had all these videos of himself filming traffic stops in his garage. And before that, a lot of people didn't really know that human smuggling unit deputies were filming themselves. So these questions arose, well, are other deputies filming themselves? Do these videos exist? Are they going to show other misconduct? Are they going to help explain all of this weird stuff that Armendariz has in his garage? And so a plan was hatched to recover the videos from other deputies. And the monitor helped come up with this plan with the sheriff's office, but then the sheriff's office completely bungled this plan. It was supposed to have an element of surprise, but instead a chief ended up sending out an email revealing the plan to everybody to recover the videos. Another big question is, were other deputies involved in seizing property, such as apparently Armendariz was, given what was in his garage? A sergeant who was in charge of doing interrogations only planned on asking four questions, yes or no questions, until the monitor intervened.
What are plaintiffs saying about these revelations? The ACLU that filed the racial profiling lawsuit must have some opinions, some thoughts about this?
So that's an interesting question. But before I go there, I wanted to say that the sheriff's office, for their part, say that this report is unfair. They say that they've invested a lot of energy and manpower into getting to the truth and that they're trying to follow the judge's orders. But back to the plaintiffs. So the plaintiffs clearly won the racial profiling case. But back several years ago during that litigation, they had asked the sheriff's office for video and audio recordings of traffic stops. And at the time, the sheriff's office didn't hand them over. They said they didn't exist. But this case clearly shows that there were tons of video recordings and that supervisors knew about it. So plaintiffs say that this was a big violation of discovery. They want more attorney's fees as a result. And according to the monitor, the videos that Armendariz shot do show some violations, unfair stops of Latino drivers, according to the monitor, as well as some strange behavior like putting drivers in handcuffs in the back of his car for traffic violations or improperly searching and towing vehicles. So there's a lot to look at here.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block with the latest on the MCSO. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
This year's race for the two open Corporation Commission seats has been clouded with millions of dollars in dark money. And this past month, almost all of it has been spent on ads attacking Democratic candidate Sandra Kennedy. As KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen reports, the ads reveal only a small portion of Kennedy's personal financial troubles.
Democratic Corporation Commission candidate Sandra Kennedy has been slammed with over $1.3 million worth of attack ads by dark money groups this month. Here's a clip of a TV ad talking about a Superior Court lawsuit she was involved in 2010.
Kennedy was an owner of a restaurant that didn't pay the rent. The rent. The restaurant franchise sued Kennedy's company for defaulting on over $30,000.
The ad's talking about a Denny's franchise in Glendale that Kennedy and her husband owned through a company called Kennedy Restaurants LLC. The ad didn't mention the fact that the case was settled out of court within a month and dismissed. But things don't end there. Records obtained by KJZZ show that last month, the federal government filed a lawsuit against Kennedy and her husband for almost $200,000 in taxes their restaurant didn't pay to the IRS. When KJZZ spoke with Kennedy this week, she said it was the first time she's even heard about the lawsuit.
I have taken great pride over the years in trying to do what's right, trying to, make sure the public could always trust in me. And to see these documents, to be honest with you, just blow me away.
About half of those taxes date back to Kennedy's first year on the Corporation Commission in 2009 and during her 2008 campaign. And the IRS started putting liens on the business in 2010, her second year in office. Kennedy says she initially spoke to the IRS and then left it to her husband to resolve.
I got the notice and I went down. And that's when I had conversation with them. And again, after that, there was never any conversation with them. And I just said to him, this is your mess. Clean it up.
She says it's her husband's debt, not hers, because she only owned 5% of the company and never handled finances.
I ran the day-to-day operations, but that was it.
But her husband, Memmi Burton, says the opposite. Burton filed bankruptcy 4 years ago, and in court filings, he said he wasn't responsible for the taxes either. In fact, he said the restaurant was, quote, operated exclusively by his wife and had no authority over operating funds or tax documents.
I thought he was in the process of paying.
And she says she had no idea what her husband was saying in court.
I guess I put my trust in my husband, and that trust has been broken.
As for the restaurant, records show the Denny's franchise company terminated its contract with Kennedy and Burton in March 2009, her third month as commissioner, after they allegedly failed to pay $39,000 in royalties and rent. But the restaurant stayed open, and the franchise company sued in federal court the next month. A year later, the case settled out of court, and Kennedy says they sold the franchise and paid their debt to Denny's.
The economy had gone bad, and we were just really trying to stay afloat. You know, trying to keep people employed.
Kennedy's term on the commission ended in 2012 after losing re-election. This year, she's giving it another shot, and her personal financial troubles really haven't been discussed beyond the attack ads. The race has instead been centered around GOP candidates Tom Farese and Doug Little, and how they've benefited from over $3 million in dark money that's widely believed to be coming from APS. It's unprecedented for a utility like APS to back the campaigns of the same people who could be its regulators. And former Commissioner Renz Jennings says it's extremely unethical.
To let the utility pick everybody who's running for office and be the screen, and to do this secretly with captive customer ratepayers, is just way beyond anything we've ever known.
And while he says Kennedy's personal financial troubles are disappointing, he thinks APS's secret backing of Farese and Little is
really dangerous for democracy.
But on Tuesday, voters will ultimately make that decision. Christina Hansen, KJZZ News.
The twists and turns in the presidential race on the Navajo Nation continue. The Navajo Supreme Court today making a decision. Joining me now to talk about what that is KJZZ's Laurel Morales. Hi, Laurel.
Hi.
So what did the Supreme Court rule today?
Well, they ruled finally to postpone the presidential election. There will be a special election held at a later date. We don't know when that will be, but they estimate it will cost $285,000. The ballots for this election, every other question on those ballots will still be counted, including a question about the first congressional district, the Kirkpatrick-Tobin race. But the president will not count on November 4th.
There is also some question about what to do with the election officials on the Navajo Nation. Did the Supreme Court take up that issue?
That's right. They did. The Navajo Board of Elections supervisors were held in contempt. There was a possibility that they could be jailed for that, but they were not. Their authority has been stripped.
And that was all over the issue of basically them not implementing the Supreme Court's original order to postpone the election, right?
Right. On October 23rd, the Supreme Court ruled to postpone the election, take Christus Cheney's name off the ballot, and put the third place finisher on the ballot.
So this would seem to be the end of the road for Christus Cheney, is that right?
That's right. He closed down his campaign earlier this week, but yeah, this is the end of the road for him, at least in this election.
Is there any sense of when we might know when the special election will be held?
There was no indication when that will be held. I imagine we'll be hearing from the director of the Navajo Election Administration soon.
Did the Supreme Court have anything significant to say about why the justices decided to rule in the way that they did?
Well, they decided not to jail the board because they didn't want them to be seen as martyrs. They indicated in terms of the, you know, postponing this presidential election that they referred to a few different cases where this was the final law. And the attorney representing Christus Cheney and in this case, the Board of Election Supervisors, he tried to rule that this should be up to the people to decide.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales in Flagstaff. Laurel, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Mark.
Still to come, it was a rainy summer, which means lots of mosquitoes in the air and in traps.
Those could sometimes come back with no mosquitoes or just a few mosquitoes, 30 or hundreds of mosquitoes. Sometimes it could go as high as thousands. Well, there was one trap at least that had about 25,000 mosquitoes.
That story is ahead. It's the show. We're still very warm around the valley this afternoon. That will change a little bit tomorrow. It'll be partly cloudy with a high of 81. Then a slight chance for rain on Sunday with a high temperature of only 71 degrees. Quickly in valley traffic, an accident on the 101 northbound at McDowell that's getting on the freeway. It's currently partly cloudy and 93 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business with an executive MBA for seniors leaders. Ranked 13th in the world by the Wall Street Journal. Open house Saturday, November 8th. Registration at execopenhouse.com.
The sides in Arizona's school funding case have been making their cases in court this week. A state judge had already ruled the state illegally shorted schools when it didn't cover inflation costs as required by a voter-approved measure. At issue now is whether the state also owes districts back pay for that time. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services has been covering the case.
The issue this week has been the approximately $1 billion that wasn't paid in the interim. And the question for the judge is it fair or equitable to give schools money that they didn't get? Now, the schools will argue, wait, we're owed the money. The argument by the attorneys for the legislature is, well, it's not like they can use the money to retroactively pay teachers, which is what this was meant for. And so they're telling the judge, you know, do not give them the $1 billion. And then there's also this interesting defense that they're calling the impossibility defense. Pretty much what they're saying is, we don't have the money, Your Honor. The money is gone. It's been spent elsewhere. We've got other obligations. And therefore, as a matter of fairness, you should decide that we don't have to repay any of what we owed.
Is there a chance that the judge, who has already decided that the state basically shorted the schools over all these years, will say, yeah, it's okay, you don't have to pay them that money that you probably should have been paying them anyway?
I think that she may end up doing a Solomon-like splitting of the baby. Some of the testimony that's been going on this week has been from school districts saying, on one hand, we need the money, that we use the money that we should have been getting the teachers on other things, and we've been using other money for maintenance, and so therefore our maintenance needs have not been met, and we can use the money for air conditioners that have fallen apart and roofs that have fallen apart. And on the other side, the legislature is trying to present evidence saying, well, you know, there is a grant program for schools that have really pressing needs, and with only a few exceptions, we have not rejected the grants. So clearly these cannot be pressing needs, Your Honor.
And whichever way the judge rules on this could have a significant impact on the state budget in the next year and potentially going forward.
Oh, definitely. We already know that if the $336 million figure is upheld and the legislature is appealing that, that that is going to put the state in a situation where not this fiscal year, but next fiscal year, where we're already heading to a deficit, that deficit could reach $1 billion. Now, if there's on top of that, you're putting in $1 billion repayment, even if you're doing it on a payment plan, you know, easy terms, you know, come in, what can I do to get you into this car? You still have an obligation out there that needs to be repaid.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
There are a lot of school board elections on this year's ballot in Arizona, and many of them are sleepy affairs. In many, the positions aren't even contested. That is definitely not the case in Gilbert. The school board race there has drawn 5 candidates for 2 seats, as well as a lot of money and more than its share of divisiveness.
The Gilbert Public School Board has found itself in the news most recently this week when it voted to remove pages from a biology textbook dealing with abortion. For some background on the board and the election, we turn to Mark Olalde. He covers education in the Southeast Valley for the Arizona Republic.
The Gilbert School Board is one of the most chaotic and, I guess you could say, intriguing school boards in the state, if not the most and only in the state. The Gilbert School Board has a lot of politics, probably more politics than any other school board in the state. And what happens a lot and why they get in the news so much is a lot of issues that the rest of us on the outside kind of looking into the governing boards might think are cut and dry, are black and white issues. And on the Gilbert School Board, they often turn into more heated kind of political debates.
So it sounds like this has led to a pretty spirited election between almost not officially 2 teams, but almost unofficially 2 teams.
Yes. Well, actually, let me give you an example of that. So last election, 3 of these seats were up for election, and that election saw just over 113,000 voters participate. Maricopa County, unfortunately, doesn't know the exact number that were eligible last time around, but this go-around, there's just over in the range of 120,000 eligible voters for the Gilbert Public Schools election. If you compare those two numbers, that voter turnout rate is incredible. It's astronomical compared to any other type of election. And then if you take it further and look at the spending, last go-around, Jill Humphreys, who got elected to a two-year term, she spent $700 to get elected. This go-around, three of the five candidates have all spent or have all raised nearly $20,000 apiece and have spent five digits to get elected. And as far as the two parties, you know, they'll obviously never say that, but there are two candidates that, if elected, would continue the board majority. Two candidates that, if elected, are very similar to kind of what's the board minority right now. And then one candidate who's kind of walking a tightrope down the middle of the line. We're not really sure what his voting patterns would be if he were to be elected.
So is all this money, is all this attention coming from parents who have kids in Gilbert Public Schools, or is it all coming from elsewhere?
A lot of it is coming from parents. The Gilbert Public Schools parents, they're used to, you know, a very high level of education for their kids. You know, it's a fantastic place to go to school, and the parents are very involved, you know, in the education.
Are the candidates themselves surprised by how energetic this campaign has been, how expensive this campaign has been?
I think to an extent, you know, the candidates come from a variety of backgrounds. So Jill Humphreys is the only one of the candidates who has run before. But some of the other candidates, they didn't even think that they were going to run. Gilbert has for several years been this kind of excitement. It's been this excitement around the school board. And I think the fact that it's picked up this much, you're right, it has definitely started to surprise some people.
Mark Olalde covers education in the Southeast Valley for the Arizona Republic.
The candidates in the race are Ron Bellis and Don Brimhall, who are seen as being aligned with the current board majority. Jill Humphreys and Charles Santa Cruz are seen as being more aligned with the current board minority. Reed Carr is the candidate Olalde referenced as walking the tightrope.
Parents have, in fact, been involved in this race, and we've spoken to two of them, each supporting a different slate of candidates. Jonah Sita has two kids in Gilbert Public Schools and supports Bellis and Brimhall. I asked him to describe the race.
Tense, divisive, polarizing.
Is that surprising to you?
I wouldn't say it's surprising to me. You know, I can probably phrase it up a couple of different ways, but it's not surprising based on what I've seen over the past 2 years from my initial involvement.
Are you surprised at how much money is involved in this race?
I'm not surprised, but I'm blown away by it in terms of, I wasn't surprised that that amount of money can be raised. I guess I'm more surprised that it would then be spent in an election for a school board chair, especially because of the fact that we're trying to raise money just to get enough paper in the classrooms. So when I see candidates spend $20,000, I think to myself, if you take $20,000, that is equivalent to putting 500 million pieces of paper in the classroom. When you think about that number, it's pretty frightening. Where are our priorities?
What does it say to you about the Gilbert Public Schools and the Gilbert Schools Governing Board when across the state you have similar races where there are candidates running uncontested, elections are being canceled, and in Gilbert you have this really hotly contested, very passionate race going on?
Well, I have to say, in one regard, people may think there's a circus within Gilbert. I will say this, as a whole, you know, regardless of who anybody is supporting, we have passion, and I really hope that at the end of the day, all that passion is for the kids. And I would rather have people involved than not involved.
Do you expect future races to be like this one in terms of the passion, the money, sort of the controversy that's been going on?
No, I don't. And the reason I say that is, number one, I am an optimist. And I think that after this race is over, there's going to be a little bit of time to exhale on some sides. I think that we're going to have an opportunity to dig in deep a little bit and uncover some things that hopefully will not take place in the next race.
Gilbert resident Jonah Sita. We turn now to Blake Saka. He has one kid in Gilbert Public Schools and one who's already graduated. He's the co-chair of a PAC supporting Humphreys and Santa Cruz.
We thought long and hard, and there were a significant number of community members, parents, teachers, that, you know, felt like the things that were going on in the school district were important enough that we needed a way to support the school board candidates.
Are you surprised at how this election is going, how contested, how heated it's been?
No, I'm not surprised given what's gone on over the last year and a half since the last election. You know, we've had all four assistant superintendents, eight principals, and more than 800 teachers and support staff leave. And so I'm not surprised that angry parents have stood up and said, this is not okay for my kids, and are willing to pitch in and help out.
In your mind, what is at stake in this election?
I believe the future of Gilbert Public Schools is at stake. Gilbert Public Schools is the reason why many, many people, myself included, moved to this community more than 20 years ago to raise our children. And I'm sick to my stomach at the number of wonderful people that have left the district over the last year and a half. And I believe we have to fight for the future of the Gilbert Public School District.
Do you think that the amount of interest and the amount of money that's being put into this race will be a precedent for future elections to the Gilbert School Board?
I hope not. I hope we can take this amount of money going forward and donate it to the Gilbert Education Foundation for teacher grants, and that this doesn't become a precedent. And ideally, I think that the controversy settles down over the next 2 years, and when we have a next school board election, it can be at a much more typical level.
Gilbert resident Blake Saka.
Just ahead, our community series, We Are the Valley, continues on wheels.
People in Phoenix just have a fresh approach to skating, and there are a lot of people that do it purely for fun.
We'll grind the rails as the show continues. It'll be partly cloudy tonight around the valley with overnight lows in the mid to upper 60s, partly cloudy for tomorrow, and much cooler with a high of 81. Look for a high temperature of 71 for Sunday. It's currently partly cloudy and 93 degrees. To the freeways, accidents I-17 northbound at Glendale, also I-10 eastbound at Warner, and I-10 westbound at 16th Street.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Country Day School, a co-educational college preparatory school from pre-K through 12th grade in Paradise Valley, hosting an open house Sunday, November 9th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Info at pcds.org.
Lots of Arizonans vote early, but if you're not one of them, Tuesday's your day. And if you're headed to the polls on Election Day, state law requires you to get enough time to do so. John Belitis practices labor and employment law with the firm Fenimore Craig in Phoenix.
Arizona's voting leave rights law guarantees to all workers 3 hours of consecutive time to go to the polls to vote. And if a person's shift starts and ends on election day, in a certain time frame that does not permit that individual at least 3 consecutive hours of time to vote, then the employer has to make up that difference under the statute.
Is this an issue in Arizona where workers don't get the time off or employers don't follow the law to allow their workers to get the time off to go vote?
Well, as far as I know, there isn't any reported case law that has arisen out of this statute. So if employers have violated the statute, either infrequently or routinely, we don't see any evidence of it, at least in case law. My sense is that this law is not very well known.
Do you think that as more and more people vote by mail and vote early and vote at voting centers, that a law like this might not even be needed at some point?
You know, clearly voting by mail is a much more convenient way of casting a ballot. I do it. And I think if everybody focused on voting by mail, just in terms of the pure convenience, nobody would go to the polls to vote. And what that tells me is that there is a segment of voters that simply prefer going through the process of traveling to the poll and casting their vote because it has some sort of, you know, inherent importance or value to them because they're exercising that right and they're going through that process to exercise the right. And because of that, because we have a segment of voters that want to do that for whatever reason, I don't think a statute like this will ever become obsolete. Because people who want to go through the process and have the experience of casting their vote, then always should have adequate time to do it.
John Belitis is an attorney practicing labor and employment law with the firm Fenimore Craig in Phoenix.
The historic ruling making marriage between same-sex couples legal in Arizona has started to have wider effects. State health officials are looking into changes to vital records like birth and death certificates. And some people may now be able to carry a spouse of the same sex on a health plan offered by their company. But as KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports, not everyone will be eligible for that benefit.
Now that a federal judge has struck down Arizona's gay marriage ban, public employees should be eligible to enroll a spouse of the same sex in their employer's health insurance plan. But with private employers, it's not a foregone conclusion.
What governs is whether your health plan and employer's health plan is governed by state law or federal law.
That's Chad Mead, an attorney who specializes in employee benefits. He says many small to medium-sized companies pay for health plans that are what's called fully insured. Those plans are covered by state law, and Mead thinks they'll have to start recognizing any spouse. But companies that offer self-funded or self-insured health care, where the benefits are just paid out of corporate assets, they can define their plans however they like. Mead says a federal court has found that the law that applies to those self-funded plans, called ERISA, doesn't explicitly require companies to recognize a same-sex marriage.
Although there was no cause of action under ERISA, there might be a cause of action under Title VII for sex discrimination.
That's exactly the argument from the group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders. It's representing a woman named Jackie Cody, whose employer refused to cover her wife. Senior staff attorney Jansen Wu.
If Jackie had been a man, she would have gotten those benefits for her wife. But simply because she is a woman, she was denied those benefits.
And as for health plans in Arizona governed by state law, Wu doesn't agree that they'll have to cover a spouse who's the same gender as an employee. Arizona doesn't have an employment non-discrimination law, and the laws that cover health benefits for employees of a private company are complicated, to say the least. But Wu says whatever the law, employers should offer coverage to the spouses of gay and lesbian workers.
Because it's the right thing to do. It's good business practice. It increases the morale of their employees.
And, says attorney Chad Mead, it could keep your company from getting sued.
You need to be conscientious of the way the winds are blowing and what courts are doing. And as of today, you could have your plan drafted in this way, and it's perfectly legal, but I think you have a target on your back.
Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Richard Lee Harris. A Virgin Galactic space tourism rocket exploded during a test flight today, killing one pilot and seriously injuring another. Stuart Witt is chief executive of Mojave Spaceport.
When we have a mishap from the test community, we find the test community is very small. We are human.
The wreckage of the crash was scattered across California's Mojave Desert, about 120 miles north of downtown Los Angeles. Virgin Galactic was founded by British billionaire Richard Branson, who tweeted that he's flying to the area to be with the team. Spaceship Two was designed to provide a suborbital thrill ride before it returns to Earth as a glider. After a judge rejected the state of Maine's efforts to quarantine Casey Hickox, the nurse who had been treating patients for Ebola in West Africa, she called the decision a good compromise.
We will only win this battle as we continue this discussion, as we gain a better collective understanding about Ebola and public health, as we overcome the fear.
The governor of Maine wanted Hickox to stay in her house for 21 days. But the judge says there is no need to isolate her, and all she must do is continue daily monitoring of her health and coordinate her travel with public health officials. Just back from the Ebola hot zone, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations says she is self-monitoring and that federal guidelines are sufficient. Samantha Power has been critical of the quarantine restrictions in some states. She tweeted a photo of herself having her temperature taken when she arrived last night at a New York City airport. A strong close on Wall Street today, record highs for both the Dow and the S&P 500. The Dow was up 195. The S&P 500 gained 23.40 points. From Washington, you're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Clarius Entertainment, presenting Before I Go to Sleep, a thriller starring Nicole Kidman, Colin Firth, and Mark Strong, now playing in theaters. This is KJZZ.
Good Friday afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
Trick-or-treaters won't be alone in the search for sweet snacks this Halloween. Here's a warning. Anyone who decorates the outside of their home with real-life pumpkins might be visited by wild animals in search of food. KJZZ's Steve Shadley wanted to learn more about bumps in the night that aren't always dressed in Halloween costumes.
Halloween wouldn't be complete without a traditional jack-o'-lantern, so this week I bought a medium-sized, slightly lopsided pumpkin to decorate my home. I grabbed a carving tool and got down to work, careful not to lose a finger.
My knife's not very sharp. Wow, it smells great. Now I'm grabbing all of the gooey, stringy stuff out of the inside of the pumpkin.
Finally, my jack-o'-lantern is finished. I wanted to put the pumpkin outside to decorate the walkway to my house, but wildlife officials say it could attract animals.
Hi, I'm Darren Julian, Urban Wildlife Specialist for Arizona Game and Fish Department, Region 6.
Julian and I met outside of his office in Mesa. We walked about 100 yards away from the building to the edge of the desert in hopes of finding some wildlife. This is where you might see one critter with a healthy appetite for pumpkins, the peccary, better known in these parts as javelina.
These javelina are following their nose, and if you've got a pumpkin out there that they can smell, they're going to find it.
Javelina look like a wild pig, but Julian says they aren't related. However, javelina do have a pig-like snout. They have coarse, bristly hair, and the older ones even have sharp, tusk-like teeth. Usually, javelina eat barrel cactus and plant roots, but when Halloween arrives, sometimes they march out of the desert into the neighborhoods.
We do see them use a lot of these natural washes as travel corridors. For example, Indian Bend Wash in Scottsdale, and the javelina have come off of McDowell Mountains, pushed their way through there, and we've actually got javelina on Camelback Mountain, for example.
I've even seen javelina in the city limits. About 20 years ago, a friend and I were hiking Phoenix South Mountain, and we ran into a small herd of the animals. They came out of nowhere, and before we knew it, they surrounded us with their noses in the air, trying to smell us. Javelina don't see too well, and after a few minutes, they walked on by like we weren't there. So yeah, they are around urban areas, and Arizona Game and Fish hears citizen complaints, especially around Halloween.
Probably more than anything, they're probably calling the police saying, you know, hooligans or kids are out there destroying pumpkins. That's not always the case. Some areas, it's probably the javelina that are coming in and tearing up the pumpkins and making quick food of them.
Arizona Game and Fish reminds us that it's illegal to feed wild animals in some parts of the state. Violators could receive a fine. Besides, javelinas can be mean and aggressive.
When they are agitated, you'll see them clicking their teeth and stuff, though. You know, I mean, popping their teeth. I mean, like... But also, you know, the sounds for, like, to warn the others is they almost like a, I call like a woof sound. Woof, woof, woof.
If you spot javelina while you're camping or they show up in your yard, make a loud noise to scare them off. Julian says pepper spray is also effective and it won't hurt them. So when you're walking around in the dark tonight and you hear this noise,
woof, woof, woof,
it could be a ghost, a witch, maybe a werewolf, but it might just be a javelina looking for a piece of tasty pumpkin. Happy Halloween, everyone. Reporting from Mesa, Steve Shadley, KJZZ News.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Nicole Stockfish, and I am attending a Halloween party dressed as Luna Lovegood from Harry Potter. She is a Hogwarts student in the Harry Potter series. My husband is being a Death Eater, so we are actually opponents this evening. I've always dressed up. I like doing do-it-yourself type costumes as opposed to store-bought generic ones. We like to kind of be a little more on the creative side.
There's going to be the costume contest for sure. There are three categories. There's, I want to say, funniest, most original, and best overall. There's cash prize for it. There are individualized gravestones with own epitaphs over there for each party guest that are hilarious and rhyming and written by my father-in-law.
That was Nicole Stockfish at a Halloween costume party with her friends and family in Scottsdale. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to try to scare us, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Last year, the city of Phoenix pushed to become the first in the U.S. to end homelessness among veterans. Even with progress in that category, homelessness has not gone away. For some groups, the focus has shifted to homeless teens and other young people, including members of the LGBT community. Morgan Ringwald is the communications director for the Phoenix-based Tumbleweed Center for Youth Development.
More than anything, we are a service provider for homeless youth on the streets, ages 12 to 25, here in Maricopa County. We're based in downtown Phoenix area, but we have organizations and facilities all around the city, primarily in Phoenix and Tempe, which is where we see most of the homeless youth that we service in the valley.
In a general sense, how big a problem? Maybe listeners are going to be thinking 12 to 25 before we even get into LGBT. How large a problem is that? And is it growing in Phoenix?
It is a problem. We service about 6,000 youths per year, and those are kids that actually reach out to us. There's thousands more. And that ranges anything from kids that are coming across the border that need help. And that also includes everybody up to young adults who find themselves without a home, without a job, without a family, and no place to go. And we help not only provide them what they need immediately, but we help try and give them the tools to empower them to go out and become, you know, useful members of society.
This is going to be anecdotal, but I've seen more people on the streets in different parts of the valley with signs indicating that they're homeless and need help. And I've noticed it seems like there are more young people, but also we've been hearing, perhaps anecdotally as well, that there are more LGBT young people in that maybe 18 to 24 range. Mm-hmm. At Tumbleweed, what have you found there, and how consistent is that with what the rest of the state is seeing, what the rest of the country may be seeing?
We do see that quite a bit. About 25%, one quarter of the kids we service identify as LGBT. Most of them report that it's a family conflict that drives them on the streets, whether they come out to their parents, their family, they find themselves maybe not accepted, maybe even kicked out. That's why we exist, to help them, you know, have a place to go and have a place to turn.
Is there a different way that Tumbleweed or other organizations approach helping a homeless person who is 17, 18, who is also LGBT, or someone who is not?
Well, I think in general, we approach all homeless youth the same way. We are certainly sensitive to the needs and issues facing the LGBT youth that we do service. We want to make sure that they're comfortable with us, that they know we understand where they're coming from. And in a lot of cases, with regard to transitional housing or emergency housing, we try and make sure that if they self-identify as LGBT, then we're going to put them in places with peers. You know, very, very sensitive to what their safety issues and concerns might be. And we try and put them in a place that's most comfortable for them.
Morgan, with sex trafficking being a concern, is there also a concern that homeless youths who are LGBT might be more susceptible to violence as well, more generally, not just sexual, but just being beaten up?
Certainly. There are a number of LGBT youth who self-report being victims of sex trafficking, sexual violence on the streets. The numbers for that group are much higher than those who identify as straight kids. And so, you know, our biggest concern is getting them off the streets.
Morgan Ringwald of the Tumbleweed Center for Youth Development in Phoenix.
If you spent any time outside recently, it will not be a surprise to hear Maricopa County has been dealing with a lot of mosquitoes. And that means more than red bumps on your arms, it means West Nile virus. The county's Environmental Services Department reports so far this year it's had 192 positive samples for West Nile. There were 139 all of last year. And there have been 65 human cases and 8 deaths from West Nile this year. Each is higher than last year's total. Johnny DeLaunay is with the county's Environmental Services Department.
These are large numbers, and of course, their numbers are more than other years, recent years, because of all the mosquito activity that we had this year.
Is it just as simple as we got a lot of rain this summer, so there are a lot more mosquitoes and therefore a lot more West Nile cases? Is there more to it than that?
Obviously, those were the elements that affected this and that caused more mosquitoes out there and more mosquito activity. We have what we call the mosquito season here that starts usually around April all the way till October. And with the monsoon during the summer months, we see an increase in the mosquito activity.
Are all of the mosquitoes that we're seeing carriers or potential carriers of West Nile, or are some just the kind that bite you and it itches for a while and it's kind of annoying?
Yeah, what we call the floodwater mosquitoes, those are the ones that reproduce in large numbers, and those are the ones that you see out there during the day that fly in groups in large numbers. And these are not known to carry West Nile or any other disease. The Culex mosquitoes, those are the ones that you see at dawn and dusk throughout the night. You typically see them in single numbers, and just one mosquito here, one mosquito there. And these are the ones that could be carrying West Nile.
Did your agency see a dramatic increase in the number of calls that you had gotten this year as opposed to previous years?
Yes. In fact, this year we broke the record a couple times. We used to have a record that was established in 2006 for the most number of mosquito-related complaints in one single week, and that was for about 1,400 calls in one week in 2006. This year, the last week of September, we registered about 2,000 mosquito-related complaints, and a couple of weeks after that, we logged in 2,400 plus, more than 2,400 mosquito-related complaints.
Wow. I just can't fathom that. In a week, getting more than 2,400 calls.
Yes, yes. And not only that, the mosquito traps that we set up and that we monitor and we use as part of our surveillance program to determine if we need to spray in an area and see what's the activity in an area, those could sometimes come back with no mosquitoes or just a few mosquitoes, 30 or hundreds of mosquitoes. Sometimes it could go as high as thousands. Well, there was one trap at least that had about 25,000 mosquitoes, which is a huge number for mosquitoes in one single trap.
Have you guys been doing more fogging this year than you have in past years?
You know, I'm not sure how it compares with past years. I know there have been years, especially because our approach has changed. Many years ago, we were really fogging a lot, so I don't know if we have fogged more this year. But since our approach changed, that we've been doing a more proactive program, the fogging activities have slowed down. And this year, because of all the water, all the accumulation of water and floods all over in Maricopa County, yes, there was a significant increase in terms of fogging if you compare that to the most recent previous years.
Johnny DeLaunay is a spokesman for the Maricopa County Environmental Services Department.
KJZZ is exploring what it means to be part of community in a series called We Are the Valley. This week, KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins introduces us to a group of Phoenix skateboarders.
My name is Bobby Green, and I've been skateboarding for 23 years. We're at the Tempe Skate Park in South Tempe. The sun is setting, it's beautiful, and we've got about 30 skateboarders out here ripping like usual. The best of the best come out here, and some of us older guys that just like to cruise around still and try and keep up. When I started skating when I was a kid, I remember if you saw somebody wearing skateboard shoes with a scuff on them, holding a skateboard, wearing a skateboard shirt, anything, you were so excited. I would approach somebody in a heartbeat. I would look across a McDonald's or wherever I was and see a kid with a hole in his shoe from skateboarding, and you'd go straight up. Hey man, what's up? You skate? Oh, awesome. Like, where you been skating at? Like, what's your name? Who are you friends with? Part of the process with skateboarding is you know you're gonna fall down. It's just getting back up. You know you're gonna get hurt. I've seen some skateboarders that didn't necessarily have health insurance per se, and they get hurt, and then suddenly they're hit with a very challenging financial situation. And next thing you know, within a couple weeks, there's flyers posted everywhere, sharing on social media. There's a fundraiser, and somebody's got several thousand dollars in donations.
My name's Ryan Lay. I've been skateboarding for 16 years.
it almost becomes a passport when you're traveling, especially internationally. You can go to a foreign country and meet someone who doesn't speak your language and instantly identify with them. And I like to think that I can literally go anywhere in the world. And if I meet skateboarders, they'll take me in, they'll show me spots, they'll show me, where to get good food. I always love the community in Arizona. The skate community is one of the best in the world, I think. There are people that, work 9-to-5 jobs or they go to school full time, and, skateboarding is their release. They come to the park, much like people go to the bar after work.
My name is Agnieszka Wusz. I've been skating for about 3 years now. I'm from Illinois, but I come out here specifically because of all the great people. I mean, great parks and, the weather, whatever, that's a bonus. But, all the people that I've met out here, that's what definitely keeps me coming back. Out here, everybody seems to, be pretty tight-knit and accepting of each other. So it makes it a little easier, to get out and, do your thing. I mean, whatever it is, it's just encouraging when you have so many, great people around you that are accepting, and it's great. The benefits of, skating with other people is just you see your friend doing something, you get hyped, you get so excited, and it's just so encouraging to watch other people skate. I can't imagine myself stopping anytime soon. If it's, one day my legs aren't working right, that's the only thing I think that would prevent me from continuing this.
That story was produced by KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. If you're part of a community that makes up a big part of your life, tell us about it for our We Are the Valley series. Just send us a note to wearethevalley@kjzz.org.
Arizona is one of nearly half a dozen states without a governor's mansion, but actually we weren't always without an official governor's residence. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez takes us to a historic home in Prescott.
A log cabin sits in the middle of the Charlotte Hall Museum campus on Gurley Street. It's the 150-year-old Arizona Governor's Mansion. Did you know it is the oldest Arizona Territory building still standing on its original location?
It was built in 1864 by Governor John Goodwin, first governor of the territory, and Richard McCormick, who was the first secretary of the territory. So they pooled their money and built this house.
Mick Woodcock is the chief curator at the Charlotte Hall Museum.
Well, it is well made. And for the time period, when you consider people were living in shacks and wagon boxes and tents, and really crude log cabins, this is a mansion for the time period.
As we make our way into the cabin, Woodcock says Goodwin and McCormick were well-off men from the East Coast. They were accustomed to more comfortable living quarters and decided to split the cost of building this home for both to live in. The Ponderosa Pine Log Cabin is a duplex with an attic and communal dining area. Goodwin lived on the south end, McCormick in the north half.
Richard McCormick goes back east on official business and gets married while he's back there, and he brings his wife back. In the meantime, Goodwin had been elected territorial representative to Congress. He's leaving. He tells the McCormicks they can do what they want with the house. He's not coming back to Arizona.
McCormick then becomes governor. He and Margaret live in the home as the first family. But the mansion was only in use for
approximately 2 years, till the territorial capital moves to Tucson.
The governor's mansion was lived in by several people and then left vacant until 1917, when the state acquired it. By 1927, Arizona territorial historian Charlotte Hall converts the mansion into a museum. The cabin has been refurbished and the front porch was added by a later owner. But there is one item in front of the house that hasn't changed. There are pink rose bushes adorning the entrance. Those are considered grandchildren to Margaret McCormick's original rose bush. Woodcock says after Margaret's death, a woman in the area noticed the rose bush was not being cared for, took a cutting and planted it in her home.
When they go to put in the rose garden down at the state capitol in Phoenix, they hear about the rose bush. they come and get a cutting and propagate that down there.
Then Charlotte Hall Museum decided to take a cutting from the rosebush at the state capitol and plant it here, thus bringing back the roses to their original home. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know something that we ought to know, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Valley residents will not fall back this weekend. Unlike most states, Arizona does not utilize daylight savings time to stay in sync with the sun.
For most of the state, clocks haven't changed since the 60s. That's in part due to Arizona's hot climate, which is easier to bear when the sun goes down.
But this choice can have different effects on Valley businesses. Bob Hollis owned the Apache Drive-In in Phoenix. He says drive-in operators have long opposed daylight savings time.
You're at the mercy of the sun, you know, especially if you have a dark movie, a dark print. It's a lot of night scenes. You even start later because you don't see the first 5-10 minutes of it, if not.
For others in the entertainment business, changing clocks would actually help boost the bottom line. Daryl Crawford is the general manager of Papago Golf Course.
We start our day and end our day based upon daylight. So as the days get shorter, our tee times start later. People have to come in earlier. And you're shrinking the opportunities you have to do rounds, and that obviously impacts your revenue.
Crawford says the way things are does allow him to save some money on greenskeeping crew costs, but he would rather golfers have more time to get in an extra nine.
Plenty of good stuff going on this weekend if you can recover after gorging yourself on Halloween candy. This is the last weekend of the Arizona State Fair. Maybe you can bring some of that Halloween candy, get it deep fried. This is your last chance for all that deep fried goodness at the State Fairgrounds in Phoenix.
But as we learned, be careful of the javelinas.
Yes.
Very, very
careful. For goodness sake, be careful of the javelinas.
And tonight as well, the Phoenix Suns play another home game as the regular season gets underway. Game number 2 tonight against the San Antonio Spurs.
Also this weekend, Wild West Days in Cave Creek. It's a 5-day-long festival celebrating the Old West. Games, events, parade, and a cattle drive through town.
And if you're not afraid of clowns like I am, you can go to Circus Vargas. That's taking place all weekend.
The show was produced this week by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about some good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ, FM Phoenix, and HD. It's 3 o'clock.